Good morning and welcome to Studio 619. I'm Rick Halbert. Coming up, I'll speak with Philip Sheenan, who's written a book about the 9/11 Commission and how it worked. First, people with mental disabilities and mental health diagnoses who are unable to live at home have essentially two options: live in a psychiatric facility or in a community setting. As WFPL's Stephanie Sanders reports, both options have effects on the health of the patient and Kentucky's bank account.
One, two, three.
Screams of delight pierce the calm afternoon air at Seneca Park, where about a dozen adults who've been diagnosed with some degree of mental retardation or mental health problems or both are playing with brightly colored parachutes. It's part of a day program through a Louisville organization called Dreams with Wings. Dreams with Wings is a community living provider, meaning they place adults with developmental problems into houses or apartments in the community, along with others like themselves and an appropriate amount of staff to support their daily living routines. The program includes residential services as well as the day program and takes pride in placing people few believed could live on their own, like Mary.
I just get excited because I know that I can live on my own again if I really try. I know I can do it.
Jennifer Frohmeyer runs Dreams with Wings and has watched people blossom in their new independence, taking responsibility and even jobs after transitioning into community living. In a state-run mental hospital, patients may undergo therapy to practice daily tasks, such as laundry or cooking meals. Frohmeyer says in their residential program, participants actually fold their own T-shirts and make their own sandwiches, and that helps them develop as a person. The challenge for Frohmeyer and others who run these community living providers is that each client is different, with unique levels of independence and medical needs. Frohmeyer says sometimes it takes a lot of work to balance the needs of the patient with the right level of staffing in each home. For example, a paraplegic needs more staff care than a person who can sustain a job and household chores. Joyce Wilson runs the Dreams with Wings Day program and has experience working in a state hospital. She thinks moving a person from a mental facility, which could house hundreds of patients, into a group home has benefits.
With the right supports, every individual can be out in the community and should be out in the community.
I'm not going to disagree with that, but today that doesn't exist.
That's Missy McKiernan. She works at the Hazelwood Center in Louisville, which is an intermediate care facility for the mentally retarded and is run by the state. Her job is to place Hazelwood clients into community living programs.
The level of medical care that some of our individuals need, they don't meet. They don't have 24-hour nursing care. If you have someone that has seizures that are like can be life-threatening, you have to have trained medical staff there to make sure that that person is safe or they could die.
McKiernan says the utopian goal would be for all residents of these state-run facilities to live in group homes, but that's several years from reality. In Kentucky, about 2,500 people are waiting for state funding for community living placement. It actually helps the state's budget to move those who can be moved into community living programs. The state-run facilities cost about $800 a day per patient, while it costs only about $168 a day in the smaller group homes. The federal government is working to move more people from hospitals to group homes. A program called Money Follows the Person wants to help Kentucky and other states start moving people into these community settings. Kentucky was awarded a $50 million grant in May of 2007 to get started, but a year later that money has yet to be tapped because state officials continue to slog through federal red tape. Meanwhile, thousands of Kentuckians with disabilities wait for a chance at community living, a chance to live their own lifestyle instead of practicing that lifestyle in a mental facility. For WFPL, I'm Stephanie Sanders.
New York Times investigative reporter Philip Sheenan has written a book about the inner workings of the commission that investigated the September 11, 2001 terrorist attacks. It's called Commission, the Uncensored History of the 9/11 Investigation. Sheenan is coming to the Louisville Free Public Library Tuesday to discuss his book. He spoke to us by phone about his coverage of the commission and reaction to his book. How long after the 9/11 attacks was this commission formed?
It was formed about 2 years afterwards, and it was after a long fight between the White House and Congress and some of the 9/11 families.
Now, who decided who would serve on this board and who would run it?
The president picked the, under the law that created the commission, the president picked the chairman of the commission. The Democrats on Capitol Hill picked the Democrats, and the rest of the Republicans were picked by Republican congressional leaders.
Now, originally, was it the White House wanted Dr. Henry Kissinger to be the chairman?
Exactly, and he stepped down pretty fast.
Why was that?
The families thought Kissinger had plenty of conflicts of interest. He was a friend of Bush's. He was perceived to be too loyal to the Bush administration, and he ran a big consulting company that represented, it was believed, a lot of energy and maybe even Saudi clients that wouldn't want to get to the bottom of 9/11.
I see. It seemed like a real panic set in just across D.C. when the commission was formed. Everybody seemed to want to kind of cover their rear ends.
Sure, there were certainly a lot of people. Certainly there was a perception that a lot of folks at the White House didn't want to see a big investigation of intelligence failures before 9/11 because it might scapegoat them for 9/11.
And actually, people in the Clinton administration as well were worried.
Sure. No, they in fact, one early anecdote in the book is that Sandy Berger, who was Bill Clinton's national security advisor, goes into the National Archives and actually starts stealing documents because he thinks some of these documents might scapegoat him and the Clinton administration for 9/11.
You paint this great picture. That's the very beginning of the book, of Berger stuffing those documents in his socks.
Apparently in his socks, in his coat, jacket, anywhere he could get him out of that building.
Was he charged criminally with that? I don't remember.
He was. He pled out. He got a plea bargain in which he was allowed to plead guilty to some minor offenses. He didn't do any jail time. There were certainly a lot of folks in Washington, Republicans and even some Democrats, who thought he should have faced a much more serious penalty.
So did you cover this commission from day one?
I was there from the first day it opened to the day it closed down, and then I covered it for the better part of a year as Congress tried to figure out how to respond, and the White House tried to figure out how to respond to the final report.
So it came to be that the former governor of New Jersey, Governor Kaine, and former Congressman Lee Hamilton, who's well-known around these parts, they were chosen to co-chair the commission eventually, correct?
Right, right. They were definitely the second choices, though, of the Republicans and the Democrats in Washington.
Now, in addition, I guess it was kind of a part-time job for them, though, wasn't it?
Kaine had actually been told he really would only have to spend about a day a week on the assignment. It turned out to be a lot more rigorous than that, though he did continue to live in New Jersey and commuted down to Washington one or two days a week.
Now, there was also an executive director?
Executive director by the name of Philip Zelikow, who's a very well-respected historian at the University of Virginia, but somebody who it was seen as having an awful lot of conflicts of interest. He was very close to a lot of people in the Bush White House who were right at the heart of the 9/11 Commission investigation, most importantly Condoleezza Rice, who was then the National Security Advisor.
Well, what were the headlines that came from this investigation? What were the major conclusions they reached?
Well, there were lots of them. I guess the principal finding was that the agencies of the federal government that dealt with terrorism weren't talking to one another. That nobody was connecting the dots within the government. That the FBI and the CIA had a lot of the clues before 9/11 that should have been able to allow somebody to prevent 9/11, but they just weren't able to coordinate that information. That the government was just dysfunctional in many ways.
Was there an indictment, so to speak, of the Saudi government in this?
Well, that was a big conflict on the staff because some of the staff members thought there should have been a pretty clear indictment of the Saudi government. There was an awful lot of evidence uncovered by a lot of young staffers to suggest that some middle-ranking folks within the Saudi government and even a Saudi diplomat in California seemed somehow to be tied into a support network for some of the 9/11 hijackers after they got to the U.S., and the staff members of the commission felt very strongly this should be in the final report, as some sort of indictment of Saudi Arabia. But the report was written in such a way that the report was really seen as an exoneration of Saudi Arabia, which led to an awful lot of bad feeling on the part of the staff.
Now you talk in the book about the Bush administration's reluctance to even have this commission, but they gave it somewhat of a small budget, didn't they?
Originally, they were given a budget, a really paltry budget, an insulting budget of only $3 million, and that may sound like an awful lot of money, but that's really nothing compared to the amount of money the government usually spends on big investigations. When the Challenger space shuttle blew up in the 1980s, the government spent, I believe, something like $70 million investigating it, yet the 9/11 Commission was given, a small fraction of that to deal with, the biggest national tragedy in the United States since Pearl Harbor.
Well, tell me a little bit about the cooperation as you went about writing the book. What kind of cooperation did you get or not get from the principals involved?
Well, I actually had a lot of cooperation. Certainly, I talked to almost all of the 9/11 commissioners. They were available to me throughout the 9/11 commission's investigation, and they were available to me for this book. What was new for me was that I finally got access to the commission staff, the people who really did the digging on the commission, and the people who really, in many ways, wrote the final report. They were barred from talking to reporters during the 20 months of the investigation. They were told they'd be fired if they talked to reporters, and they lived, they agreed to that rule. But after the commission went out of business, those people were available to me, and a lot of them were eager to talk to me to tell me, you know, great stories, great detective stories about how they dug out their evidence, and also stories about these big battles that apparently were being waged within the staff of the 9/11 Commission.
What kind of response have you gotten so far from the Bush administration and others?
Bush administration is not very happy with the book. I certainly get the impression that Secretary of State Rice and her staff are quite unhappy with it. The 9/11 commissioners and some of the staff aren't happy with it either, because I guess they perceive the book as having tarnished the reputation of the 9/11 Commission, which obviously has enjoyed a pretty golden reputation since it went out of business. You know, it was seen as a demonstration of real bipartisanship in Washington in a time when there's not much of it. But I think the book points out that the 9/11 Commission missed an awful lot, and you know, some of its conclusions are probably suspect in a way people didn't realize before.
One little interesting tidbit before we go about John McCain I saw in the book. Maybe I just wasn't paying attention at the time, but he came very close to bolting the Republican Party after the 2000 election.
You know, I'm actually surprised more people didn't focus on that in the book when it came out, because it came out just at the sort of the height of a lot of what was going on in Washington in terms of presidential politics. But no, he apparently was very close to becoming a Democrat in 2001 and 2002. Because he was so angry with George Bush and Karl Rove and the way that he, John McCain, had been treated in the 2000 election.
And to the point of talking about the details of the press conference he was going to have to talk to discuss it.
He apparently got very, very close to making the decision to announce that he was becoming a Democrat, or at least becoming an independent. What happened is that at this time the Senate was almost evenly split between Democrats and Republicans. But one of the Republicans, Jim Jeffords of Vermont, announced in the summer of 2002 that actually he was going to switch from being a Republican to being an independent. So the power went to the Democrats, and McCain apparently told the Democrats, well, you don't need me anymore.
Hmm. And now he's the presumptive Republican nominee for president.
Yeah, how about that?
Well, I know you're coming to Louisville to talk about the book, correct?
Yeah, no, I've been around a bit. An awful lot of book touring in this day and age is, you know, you get on telephones and you get on satellite radio and satellite television. So I'm delighted to have the chance to actually get physically to Louisville.
The name of the book is The Commission, Uncensored History of the 9/11 Investigation. And Phil Sheenan of the New York Times is the author. Thanks for joining us this morning.
Thanks so much.
Philip Sheenan will talk about his book Tuesday night at the Louisville Free Public Library. When we come back, the future of freshwater mussels in Kentucky. You're in Studio 619 on WFPL. Welcome back to Studio 619. I'm Rick Heldet. Coming up, more on the concept of local living economies. But first, Kentucky's rivers and streams once carried more than 100 species of freshwater mussels. Today, nearly a quarter are endangered, and many are already gone. WFPL's Kristen Espelon reports on why mussels matter and how efforts to bring them back are breaking new scientific ground.
Found one?
Yeah,
biologist Fritz Vorsek pops out of the stream and lifts up his mask and snorkel. He's spotted a rather small mussel nestled in the stream bed. He trudges toward the bank to hand it to fellow Department of Fish and Wildlife biologist Monty McGregor, who will give it a closer look. They're combing a section of stream in the Upper Cumberland River system for an endangered mussel species called the Cumberland bean. It's a black bean-shaped mussel that could easily fit in the center of the palm of your hand. They're trying to find pregnant, or gravid in the mollusk world, females, and they're finding anything but.
I've got four females of Painted Creek Shell, four females of the rainbow mussel that are gravid that I'll be taking back, and we'll be doing some work with them as well.
McGregor kneels near the bank, sorting through a small pile of mussels the two have found. Some he'll take back to his lab, and others he'll replant in the stream. Last year, they tagged Cumberland bean females with a little magnetic sticker and plopped them back in the water. Today, they've come back with a kind of aquatic metal detector to try to pick up their signals, but the search has turned up little.
It's not good seeing all the dead animals here. That's kind of alarming. We're not sure why they're dying. Again, they're very sensitive animals.
Sensitive, that is, to environmental stresses. A sizable mussel population can tell you a lot about the health of that river or stream. Mussels filter water through little muscular tubes to feed on algae and bacteria. One mussel can filter many gallons a day. That keeps the water clean, but it also makes mussels little underwater canaries in the coal mine. They're the first to die when water quality declines. And two key factors have damaged water quality in the state. That's why McGregor is trying to raise endangered mussels in captivity. Returning them to the wild and encouraging new populations would help Kentucky waterways. But he must battle pollution, and he must battle dams. U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service mussel biologist Bob Butler works out of his North Carolina office to bring endangered mussels back from the brink. He blames dams for most of that endangerment.
When you put a dam in, you change running water environment to a standing water environment, and it starts to fill up with sediments.
And that destroys the rich mixture of gravel and sand and pebbles mussels love to nestle in. And it makes it tougher for them to feed on their preferred diet of algae because of all the other particles clouding the water. They starve to death. But it also makes it harder to breed. Mussels develop a clutch of microscopic eggs inside their shells. Then they wait for the right fish to come along. This is the fish that will host their brood in its gills for a little while, unaware that hundreds of little mussel eggs are nourishing themselves in its fish blood. Each mussel species, it seems, prefers its own species of fish. And biologist Bob Butler says dams have affected those fish populations, too.
The fish host for most of these mussels are small benthic species like darters and sculpins, maybe catfish and some shiners that also need running water to survive. So the fish communities change, the mussel communities change when you put dams in.
Coaxing those communities back is no easy task. Welcome to McGregor's Mussel Nursery, just a few miles outside downtown Frankfort. In a room full of gurgling tanks and plastic tubes, two scientists are huddled over a petri dish with a long eyedropper and a bucket of woozy fish. McGregor says the barely visible specks in that petri dish are the result of a third trip to the river that netted a bit more success.
Those little specks are several thousand of that Cumberland bean mussel that we went looking for. And what he's doing is they've put the fish to sleep a little bit with the anesthetic, and then he's actually squirting them right on the gills. This way we know for sure. And when you're working with an endangered mussel, you want to make sure that you take advantage of every larvae.
Until recently, scientists didn't know which fish each mussel preferred. It's taken educated guessing and trial and error to figure it out. It's also only in the last few years that scientists have learned what to feed these babies. McGregor and his staff are still figuring out the recipes in this, the mussel's own personal kitchen. Algae is the main ingredient, but getting the mixture just right requires a little experimentation. And experiments are bubbling up through dozens of tanks and tubes, including a giant cylinder next to McGregor all over this part of the lab. That giant cylinder holds a disturbing fluorescent green liquid that's on its way to becoming the kind of dark green sludge mussels salivate over.
So you can see the progression from light green to dark green to very dark green where we harvest in. This procedure, you know, has been taking a couple, 3 years to develop how the proper way to getting the right algae that's the right for the right mussel.
More recent developments may allow McGregor to rear some mussel eggs right in the lab without a host fish. Hundreds of eggs are put in a dish with a chemical stew of amino acids and vitamins and minerals. If the mix is just right, they grow up. But until the last few years, scientists had little success.
The technique was developed in the early 80s. But really, there's only been a few people that have tried to work it out.
McGregor says the process is working, but he needs to try it out on some more species. With so many steps involved in breeding and raising mussels, it seems that recovering any of the endangered species could take forever. But McGregor says otherwise.
So in my lifetime, yes, I think we have a better chance of getting a species maybe off the endangered species list. But again, you know, it takes a lot of time, multiple years of raising animals, putting them back, and getting new populations established.
He acknowledges that he can only hope to establish new populations in healthy streams and rivers. In Kentucky, the federal government recognizes more than 1,000 miles of waterways as impaired or not so healthy. For WFPL, I'm Kristen Espeland.
For years, Judy Wicks has been a leading figure in the local living economies movement. The Philadelphia restaurant owner travels the world to talk about her success in operating a sustainable business and to help communities develop their own local living economies. She's in Louisville this weekend to deliver a talk at the Clifton Center. We caught up with her by phone at her Philadelphia restaurant. Our conversation begins with her explanation of the term local living economy.
We call it a living economy because it supports both natural life and also supports a vibrant community life. And we call it local because we believe that local business ownership is bringing economic power to communities away from faraway boardrooms where decisions are often made not in the best interest of communities.
Now, how did you get involved in this?
Well, really from my own work as a small business owner. I own a restaurant in Philadelphia called the White Dog Cafe, and we're 25 years old this year. And for over 20 years, I've been buying from local farmers and realizing how important it is to build a sustainable local food system. And I sort of had a threshold crossing moment when I realized that it wasn't enough just to have these practices within my company of buying from local farmers and having other green practices, but rather one needed to be a part of a sustainable system, and that it was building that system that was most important. So rather than keeping that market niche to myself as being the only restaurant in town that bought all of our meat and poultry from local farmers where they raised the animals on pasture and organic vegetables and so on, I decided that I would start a nonprofit and teach my competitors how to buy from local farmers to build the whole local food system. So that's when I kind of got into it, realizing that we needed to work in cooperation to build sustainable systems.
I see. Now, you are in Philadelphia. Now, have your competitors picked up on this?
Oh, yeah. This was about this was in 2001, 7 years ago, when we first started this. We have what we call the Fair Food Project, and so not only do we continue to provide consulting to restaurants and stores and on how to buy from farmers, but we also publish a guide to local food for consumers and a wholesale guide for buying directly from farmers for businesses. We have various other programs. Our Farm to Institution program tries to link up larger institutions like schools and hospitals with local farms and so on. And then also I started in Philadelphia the Sustainable Business Network to perpetuate our business model of measuring our success not just by profit but also our impact on the environment and on people, which is now commonly thought of as being the triple bottom line business that measures success by people and planet as well as by profit.
That was Judy Wicks, owner of the White Dog Cafe in Philadelphia and co-founder of the National Business Alliance for Local Living Economies. She'll speak this evening at 7 o'clock at the Clifton Center in Louisville and will lead a business breakfast there tomorrow morning. She'll also be a guest on WFPL's State of Affairs program Tuesday morning at 11. What does it take to run a nonprofit? Well, for one thing, it takes a board of directors, but what do those board members do, and what are they supposed to be doing? Stephanie Sanders spoke with Eric Schmall about boards, who's on them, and how they can get better. He's the instructor of seminars that start this week called Get On Board through the Center for Nonprofit Excellence.
Let me start by asking you, what is a board? What is the function of a board of directors?
Well, in the nonprofit sector, the board is charged with giving overall oversight to the organization, leadership, and essentially they're the people who are ultimately responsible for the organization in terms of its commitment to the community to help it succeed in its mission.
And who serves on boards like these?
Well, typically these are almost all volunteers. This is a volunteer activity. people who embrace this role say that they want to help lead the organization, help bring resources to it, help inspire it, and evangelize what the organization is trying to achieve.
So tell me about the Get On Board seminar series and some of the things you hope to accomplish with that.
Well, the Get On Board series is put into place mainly to help board members become better at their role in governing. It's specifically aimed at people who might be fairly new at being board members, as well as people who are contemplating whether or not they think they're ready to take on the challenge of that. So, but it's open to anybody who is either, but maybe even been on a board for a long time and just wants to sharpen their skills in some way. We want to do our best to inform people on how to, you know, what looks good in terms of board behavior. You know, what do exceptional boards look like in terms of being able to discharge their duties and help their organization succeed. You don't come to that kind of volunteer work knowing that instinctually. It has to be, you know, you have to learn it. And this is an opportunity to learn it in a, I don't want to say purely academic way, but we do introduce concepts and we do offer lots of expertise and I want to call them little mini exercises where we try to get people to understand. So this is what good board work looks like. Okay, I think I'm ready for that.
And what's can you talk a little bit about perhaps the need for a seminar like that? Do you find at your center that there are a lot of boards out in existence that aren't necessarily working at the level that they could?
Yes, I think lots of boards, well, every board I work with, first of all, is very well-intentioned. They certainly have the desire to want to help their organization succeed, or they wouldn't be there. So we'll start with that premise. And then it's just a matter of saying, all right, is wanting to succeed enough? And, well, just like anything else, desire is a good first step, but expertise and some knowledge about what it takes to succeed is the next logical second step. And I think there's a large need for people to become more confident in trying to succeed by saying, well, you know, what are the lessons? What do I need to know so that I can in fact do better in this job? And much of what I do in my consulting role with the center is going and visiting boards and talking with them, giving them some insight into good board work, and in some cases staying with them on a longer term basis, kind of like a board coach or a board mentor to help raise their level of confidence and encourage them and get them to a point where they don't, you know, they can do that on their own.
Do you find in that consulting role that you find either maybe some board members or boards as a whole who maybe jumped into the role thinking, oh, well, this is something I really care about and want to do well, and then they're like, oh, hey, whoa, this takes a lot more than I thought it did.
Oh, yeah. There's lots of people come to this position with preconceived notions about, well, maybe it's either easier or tougher than I thought. Sometimes people come to board service with that very good intention, and they might walk in on a board that is really performing at a sub-rate level. You're not doing very well at all. And you can learn, I'm going to say, in your initial contact with a board that is underperforming, you can learn some bad habits that way if you're not formed well. And again, we want to try to get people to understand that maybe your board experience was suboptimal, and there might be a better way.
There's still time to register to participate in the seminars, which take place on Thursdays through May 22nd. For links to the Center for Nonprofit Excellence and more information on registration, go to WFPL.org. When we come back, Indiana's role in the Democratic primary for president in 1968. You're in Studio 619 on WFPL. Welcome back to Studio 619. I'm Rick Heldet. Coming up, Gabe Bullard talks to a woman who's living in a Humane Society shelter to raise money for the organization. First, in 1968, as today, the Democratic Party was split between candidates for the presidential nomination. Much to everyone's surprise, Eugene McCarthy narrowly lost to President Lyndon Johnson in the New Hampshire primary. And then in March, Senator Robert Kennedy surprised everyone by entering the race. Shortly thereafter, President Johnson dropped out and left the Senators McCarthy and Kennedy to battle it out in the next state's primary. That state, Indiana. Robin Fisher spoke with author and historian Ray E. Boomhauer about this pivotal election and his latest book, Robert F. Kennedy and the 1968 Indiana Primary.
Well, I want you to set the stage for us at the beginning of the presidential campaign season in 1968, before Kennedy got into the race.
Well, 1968 was a momentous year in American politics. You had Richard Nixon on the Republican side trying to resurrect his political career by running for the Republican nomination. You had George Wallace kind of waiting in the wings as a possible third-party candidate. And the Democratic Party had its own insurgent candidate in Eugene McCarthy, the senator from Minnesota, who challenged Lyndon Johnson, the incumbent president, in the New Hampshire primary. And at that time, when McCarthy announced his candidacy in December 1967, leading up to the 68 race, he didn't stand much chance, according to the political pundits. In fact, only 60% of the American public didn't even know who McCarthy was. So he wasn't given much of a chance in the opening New Hampshire primary. But he fooled a lot of prognosticators. His message, his anti-Vietnam War message, was picked up and followed by a lot of young college students who trooped to New Hampshire to canvass on his behalf, cutting off their beards and their long hair and becoming clean for Gene. And with the New Hampshire results, McCarthy barely lost to Johnson in that primary and did much better than expected, and really shocked everyone with his good standing in the primary.
Well, I found it interesting in the beginning of the book you talk about how hard people looked for someone within the Democratic primary to run against Johnson.
There was a great revulsion against LBJ at that time. There kind of been growing a credibility gap with a lot of pronouncements by the LBJ administration not being seen as very truthful, growing unease with his Vietnam policies, particularly among young liberal members of the Democratic Party and a lot of students. And they were searching for any candidate who could take on Johnson. They approached Bobby Kennedy at first, and he turned them down, thinking that it would be seen as a personality clash between he and LBJ. Those two had never gotten along. In fact, someone had written a book whose title I love, and it really perfectly describes their relationship. It was called Mutual Contempt, and the two did not get along very well at all. So he turned them down. George McGovern was also asked. He declined, but he suggested Eugene McCarthy as a possibility, and that's when the McCarthy candidacy really took off.
So what made Bobby Kennedy change his mind?
He thought that if he ran, of course, it was seen as a personality clash with Johnson, that he would be splitting the Democratic Party at his own personal ambition. But with McCarthy's strong showing in New Hampshire, the Democratic Party was already split. So he saw it as an opportunity to have his own message to the American voters. And just a few days, March 16th, in fact, he decided to jump into the presidential race himself. This was not looked upon very kindly by a lot of McCarthy supporters. They saw it as kind of stepping on their glory. One columnist said that Kennedy was coming down out of the hills to shoot the wounded. One of the McCarthy's young supporters said it was like being waking up on Christmas morning, coming down to the tree and finding that Robert Kennedy had stolen all the Christmas presents.
Now, it's just hard for me to believe, sitting here in 2008, that a presidential candidate entered the race in March.
That's right, only just a few months before the August convention. We're used to today to having candidacy declare their intentions years ahead of time and having an apparatus in place to help them in the primaries that would be coming up, but Kennedy had a very small time to get his message across to voters, and Indiana was the first primary available to him to test his chances with the voters.
Did he see Indiana as sort of a microcosm of the country?
In a bit. Indiana, of course, had a strong agricultural background, but also a lot of factories. It had an African-American population, a lot of college students and campuses across the state. But Indiana was not seen as very fertile ground for the candidacy. It was seen as a more conservative state in the Midwest. Kennedy's advisors were not very thrilled about him entering the race, entering the Indiana primary, terming it a big gamble. But as Kennedy himself said, his whole campaign was a gamble, and this would be a good opportunity to test himself with the voters. A lot of his advisors were also put off by the fact that the state's popular governor, Roger Brannigan, was going to be running as a stand-in for Lyndon Johnson in the primary. And they saw him as the most difficult opponent in that race.
Now tell me a little bit about Brannigan, and how does that work, being a stand-in for someone who has chosen not to run?
Well, at that time, when Kennedy announced, Johnson was still in the race. And so he had some surrogates running in his place in some states. It's a role that Matthew Welsh, Indiana's governor back in 64, had played when Johnson was running for his first real election after taking over for John Kennedy following his assassination. So basically, if Brannigan ran and won the delegates, he would be pledged toward Johnson at the upcoming convention. But Brannigan was a very popular Indiana political figure. He was known as someone who you could call upon to speak at any occasion. He was a Harvard Law School graduate, a well-known attorney, and probably the governor that knew the most about Indiana's past, had a large library, and really knew his stuff about Indiana history.
You know, something that I found interesting that you talked about all of the campaigns was the use of historians as campaign advisors.
That's right. Kennedy had the good luck to know John Bartlow Martin, who was a former reporter from the Indianapolis Times, had grown up in Indianapolis during the Great Depression, and had written a well-regarded history of the state called Indiana and Interpretation. He was later was a nationally known freelance reporter and had worked in Democratic Party politics since the days of Adlai Stevenson. And he kind of created a niche for himself in party politics as an editorial advance man. He would go out ahead of the candidate when they were going to appear in a community and talk to newspaper reporters, local police, fire officials, and anyone he could get a hold of, and get some background for the candidate about that particular community. And so they'd be well-informed when they came into a town and faced the voters. And that's a role he played in Indiana. He knew the state so well that Kennedy could rely upon him for good information about wherever he went on his campaign.
Well, you know, I am of the age where I grew up with the Kennedy mythology. Mm-hmm. And I don't have any personal recollection of President Kennedy or Senator Kennedy. So I was surprised to read in your book the negative reaction of the press to Kennedy. I guess I had always assumed he had been sort of a favorite.
Well, he was a favorite for a lot of press. Some journalists were a little worried because they thought they'd fall under the Kennedy mystique, and so they, to show that they would be have no favorites, they would treat Kennedy fairly poorly sometimes. And he never really got a lot of good press from the New York Times. And he once joked that during his first run for the Senate in New York, that taking off on an ad campaign by the New York Times, that he could say that he did not get his job through the New York Times. But the national press followed Kennedy as he took his effort to Indiana and really invaded the state.
As he went through the state campaigning, he seemed to, of course, pick up momentum.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us about April 4th, 1968.
April 4th was Kennedy's really kickoff of his Indiana campaign. He started in the morning with an appearance at the University of Notre Dame in South Bend, where he gave a speech to thousands of students there at the Stepan Center, talked about hunger in American society and the need to help the disadvantaged. From there, he flew on to another speech in Muncie at Ball State University, where more than 12,000 people crowded into the men's gym there to hear another speech along the lines he gave in at Notre Dame. And he was then scheduled to fly on to Indianapolis for two campaign stops, one to open up his new Kennedy for President headquarters in downtown Indianapolis, and another an appearance at a rally at an African-American neighborhood at 17th and Broadway Streets. There was a voter registration drive going on there as well in advance of the rally. And as he was leaving Muncie, he heard the news that Martin Luther King Jr. had been shot in Memphis, Tennessee. And when he landed at Indianapolis, he heard the news that King had actually died. And there was a lot of debate in the Kennedy camp on whether he should cancel his appearance at the outdoor rally. There was some pressure from local city officials who feared that violence might break out, as it had in a lot of major cities across the country upon the news of King's death. There were a lot of riots and violence and looting and burning going on in major American cities at that time. But Kennedy decided to cancel his appearance at the campaign headquarters, but go on ahead and appear at the rally and let them know. A lot of them didn't know King had been shot and killed, and Kennedy decided to make an appearance there and inform the crowd of that fact.
And he gives an impromptu speech that goes down in history.
That's right, a six-minute speech that he made up on his way from the airport to the site in downtown Indianapolis. On his way there, he was accompanied by a campaign aide named Fred Dutton. And Dutton remembered him kind of saying rhetorically, you know, what am I going to say to these people? And Dutton really didn't know what he was going to say. Meanwhile, one of the Kennedy speechwriters, Adam Walensky, was at the Murat Hotel in Indianapolis trying to come up with some things for Kennedy to say, and he met him at the rally site and handed him a few notes, but Kennedy never referred to them. He really spoke from the heart, and there was kind of a collective gasp that ran through the crowd when Kennedy informed them that King had been killed, and he called upon them for compassion, for understanding, really a moving speech against violence, and for love and understanding in American society.
Well, Ray Boomhauer, thank you for your time today.
I appreciate it, Robin.
That was WFPL's Robin Fisher talking with author and historian Ray E. Boomhauer about his latest book, Robert F. Kennedy and the 1968 Indiana Primary. Boomhauer will be signing copies of his book at Destinations Booksellers in New Albany Saturday evening at 7. More information is available at our website, WFPL.org. On April 7th, Rhonda Estes walked into work at the Madison County Humane Society in Anderson, Indiana, and she hasn't left the building since. Estes is spending 30 days in the shelter as part of a fundraising effort. The shelter needs to recoup about $65,000 that was allegedly embezzled. Gabe Buller talked with Estes about her stay.
How did you come to the decision to sleep in the Humane Society?
Well, we were looking for fundraisers to keep our doors open. We were down to 6 months of operation expenses left, and was looking at different fundraisers, and Jelen Bell was one of them that I was looking at, and I couldn't figure out how to do it, so I run it by the staff about me staying in here, and they all liked the idea, and it just kind of went from there.
When was your first night in the shelter?
April 7th.
And how long will you stay there?
30 days.
All right, so May 7th you'll be
out,
and you work at the shelter too?
I'm the adoption coordinator.
All right. So has the staff been pretty friendly about you sleeping there?
Oh, yeah. they get a lot of jokes out of this, but...
Are you making money from it, or are people sending donations?
So far, I just figured up today, and I've raised $8,000 so far.
And how much are you looking to get?
My goal is $10,000.
All right. And you had some financial problems, too, why you're doing this.
Yeah, that's why we're doing this. We're going to have to close our doors. We're a no-kill facility, and we didn't know what would happen to our animals.
Okay, and there was an embezzlement issue, too, right?
She stole 65,000.
Who was that?
It was our previous treasurer, Sherry. She did get arrested, and she's out on bail right now pending the criminal case.
Will you
have a civil case following the criminal case.
After that civil case, will you stand to get any of that money back?
We're asking for restitution. I don't know that we'll ever see that money, but that's what we're asking the courts for.
All right. So could you please describe your living situation there in the shelter?
It's cold. It's loud. Luckily, I don't have a sense of smell. I was born that way, so I'm sure it has an odor, but not that bad is what everyone tells me. But I blow up my mattress every night and have my dinner over there, and I let one dog out at a time to run around and play. And
what do you cook there in the shelter?
Pardon?
What do you cook in the shelter?
I've got TV dinners. Last night I just had a sandwich. And I've got people that occasionally have been dropping by meals, good meals, so...
Do you have a lot of company over at night, or is there much to do?
There's not a whole lot to do. Tonight I get a Yahtzee partner. She's going to come down and play Yahtzee. It's our shelter manager. She's just going to stay over a little bit this afternoon, and we're going to play Yahtzee. But no, it's pretty quiet.
And is there a bathroom and everything, and that's all set up for you?
There is a bathroom there, and I use the tub that we bathe our dogs in, but I do bleach it out before I use it every day.
Good idea.
Yeah.
And are you concerned about your safety?
Well, the police have been notified, and I do have a different volunteer each night that comes in and is around here with me. So I'm not here by myself every night.
So are the police checking in on you?
They do. I had one stop by last night when I stepped outside. And
I imagine all those animals, though, that's kind of like a built-in burglar alarm if somebody tries to break in.
Nobody's going to sneak up on us, that's for sure. The sound is deafening. It's very loud.
Do the dogs bark all night, too?
Some nights, yes. Night before last, it was every hour on the hour, it seemed like.
So,
now last night, if they did, I didn't hear them because I was so dead tired, I slept all night.
Do you get regular sleep, or is this a pretty big disruption to your schedule?
I don't get very much sleep, as a rule. I mean, it's just...
Like before you moved into the shelter, you didn't get much sleep?
Oh, no, I slept good before I moved in.
So are you going to... I guess you'll be pretty happy to move out of the shelter. Thank you very much for your time, Ms. Estes.
Okay.
That was WFPL's Gabe Buller talking with Madison County Humane Society Adoption Coordinator Rhonda Estes. She's spending 30 days in the shelter to raise money. You can learn more about today's show or start an online conversation on our blog at WFPL.org. You can also email us from there or listen to previous broadcasts in our audio archive. You can also write to us at Studio 619, 619 South 4th Street, Louisville, Kentucky, 40202, or you can reach us by phone at 502-814-6500. Studio 619 is produced by Louisville Public Media. Everything you hear on Studio 619 is compiled by the staff at LPM, which includes WFPL, WFPK, and WUOL. We also air submissions from Kentucky Public Radio, a collaboration of all the public radio stations in the Commonwealth. I'm Rick Howlett. Join us next time for another edition of Studio 619 on WFPL.